Welcome to each of you this evening. Some of us heard Dr. Robert this morning in the seminary chapel, and I will reintroduce her again. So those of you who were here this morning, this is a bit of a repeat. But for those who have not yet met her, I want to introduce her and remind us all that she will be at the university chapel tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock as well. I believe most of you are aware that this lectureship is sponsored by the Augsburger Lecture Series, which was funded by President Emeritus Myron Augsburger and his wife Esther. Myron was with us this morning, and I think he's back tomorrow morning, but unable to be here this evening. And we express our thanks to them for having endowed this lectureship series. And I invite you, as you have opportunities, to share your gratitude with them. Thank them for making these lectures possible each year. Dr. Dana Robert is the Truman Collins Professor of World Christianity and History of Mission and Director of the Center of Global Christianity and Mission at Boston University. And over dinner this evening, she suggested to us that her topic tonight will focus primarily on history. She is a historian by training, turned missiologist, so she is bringing that perspective to us this evening. The center that she directs comes from this perspective. Christianity is now a worldwide faith with believers evenly distributed across the continents. The Center for Global Christianity and Mission is committed to supporting and understanding the global Christian community through critical reflection, faithful witness, and thoughtful engagement with multiple cultures. She lectures widely. She is an author of numerous articles and books on the theme of mission. Most recent books are Christian Mission, How Christianity Became a World Religion, and Converting Colonialism, Visions and Realities in Mission History, 1706 to 1914. Her research and teaching interests span the fields of mission history, the history of world Christianity, and mission theology. And she has directed more than 60 doctoral students at Boston University. And many of these former students hold teaching and ministry positions around the world. She's a graduate of Louisiana State University, and her PhD is from Yale University. And as we learned this morning, her husband is from Zimbabwe. He still spends, we learned this evening, approximately 6 months each year there in Zimbabwe, and that takes Dana back there occasionally as well, each year for about a month. But they're working through those transitions and thinking about him returning from there more permanently. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert to this evening's lecture.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you again, and I've had a wonderful day looking at your beautiful campus and meeting people. Thank you very much for this invitation to be the Augsburger Lecturer. It's a big honor. This sixth lecture series is on friendship as missional practice, and tonight I'm going to talk about mission history as a history of friendships. I am a historian, and so for me, this is the fun part. I was told this morning that people like to hear people tell stories in these lecture series, so I'll tell a few stories tonight. What a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to God in prayer. And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own, and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known. Jesus is all the world to me, my life, my joy, my all. He is my strength from day to day. Without him, I would fall. When I am sad, to him I go. No other one can cheer me so. When I am sad, he makes me glad. He's My Friend. Now, these are the hymns I grew up with. Hymns about Jesus being my friend were the ones that I sang in my small Methodist church in Louisiana as a child. These kind of hymns fed the deep wells of our identity as people called into a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So to be a Christian was to know Jesus. And to know Jesus is a relationship so intimate that He carries my burdens. Jesus brings me joy. Jesus walks beside me in a garden and tells me I belong to Him. So this is the spirituality of many of us who grew up in middle-class evangelical churches in the U.S. But in my church today in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we never sing these kinds of hymns. Aren't we adults now? Do I really need Jesus holding my hand? After all, we support social justice causes that will transform the world. The robed choir sings more sophisticated music than the gospel songs of a century ago. And isn't the whole idea of Jesus being my friend a kind of North American middle class thing, a comfort food like meatloaf or apple pie? Is Jesus being my friend a retreat into a private spirituality that avoids all the hard challenges of the real world? Well, maybe. But perhaps there's another reason for why we don't sing about Jesus and friendship anymore in the church I go to. Deep down, we suspect that being friends with Jesus just might demand too much. Maybe being friends with God is too scary. For one thing, it means we must really believe that Jesus lives and that He cares about our daily lives. Being friends with Jesus means we have to let Him into the nooks and crannies of our inner selves, the places we keep hidden and where we feel vulnerable and don't really want anybody to see. Letting Jesus be my friend is also dangerous, because when I walk beside my friend, He will lead me in directions I would rather not go. Maybe into neighborhoods I would rather avoid, or introduce me to some other of His friends that I really am not sure I want to know. So we have ambivalent feelings about Jesus being our friend. But in historical perspective, the idea of Jesus as our friend is often the entry point to the demanding call to discipleship. In missional perspective, friendship with God and with each other forces us to be accountable to God and to our neighbor. So in this lecture, I'm going to use mission history as a framework for exploring a few ways in which cross-cultural friendship is our incarnational mission practice. Of all the kinds of friendship, those that cross cultural boundaries are perhaps the most difficult. And if you think about the incarnation and Jesus being on earth, that was a huge boundary for God to cross. Crossing cultural boundaries is fraught with misunderstandings. It's where we make mistakes. And yet, without commitment to persons unlike ourselves, the gospel can't spread from place to place. Cross-cultural friendship binds together the community because it is grounded in our relationship with Jesus Christ. Friendship shares visions of shalom, of community, broader than just our own little nuclear family or our own tribe or our own neighborhood. Friendship bridges the gap between the local church and living in the light of God's kingdom. So what if we wrote mission history not as a series of the exploits of missionaries who've gone from one place to another, but of the history of cross-cultural relationships? We could do that. We'd start with Jesus and go down through 2,000 years of history. Jesus had friends. He ate with his friends. He went to parties with his friends. Think of the wedding, where he changes water into wine. He traveled with his friends. He raised one from the dead. He prayed for them in the Garden of Gethsemane before he died. So through the bonds of friendship, the good news spread from Jesus to his disciples and from one person to another, down through history like a chain, all the way to us, to those of us sitting here in this chapel tonight. We can sing about our friendship with Jesus because we stand on the shoulders of the Christian community that's gone before us. Let's examine then the ethic of friendship as a missional practice by looking at three aspects that one sees repeatedly in the history of missions. And I'll use an example from the Gospel of John or something like that to start so you can see Jesus in light of these trends in the history of Christian mission. The three ethical practices that I'd like to bring up. First, that of remaining. Second, mutuality. And third, the beloved community. First, staying and remaining. One of the key themes in the book of John is that of remaining. And as I mentioned this morning, the verb meno, which sounds a lot like Mennonite, doesn't it? Means to remain, to stay, abide, dwell, and endure. This word occurs 40 times in the Gospel of John. The discussion of vine and branches in John 15 is all about abiding in the vine and remaining embedded in a relationship with Jesus Christ. John 15, verses 9 through 10, as the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. Remain in my love. Stay in my love. Dwell in my love. Endure in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. When Jesus called his disciples, it states in John 1 that Jesus turned and saw them following. John chapter 1, verses 38 and 9. And he said to them, "What are you looking for?" They said to him, "Rabbi," which translated means teacher, "where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and see." They came and saw where he was staying, and they remained with him that day. Now, this idea of remaining and abiding with Jesus is used in multiple ways, both in the sense of Jesus being fully present to the disciples and the physical and psychological solidarity with humanity that characterizes the concept of incarnation. Thus, you could say that remaining points us to the foundation of what we call missionary identification, namely, being in total solidarity with those we are trying to reach. To be in mission in the way of Jesus Christ means modeling our commitments on those of the friendship of Jesus with his disciples, the friendship of remaining, of abiding in the vine and sticking it out together through thick or thin. Now, usually, you know, when we think about mission, we think about going somewhere. We don't think about staying. Yet, mission is all about staying and remaining with people. And that's the side that I want to lift up, because so often we think about the going part of mission rather than the remaining. And now I'll give a couple of examples from history. One of these is St. Patrick. We just celebrated St. Patrick's Day. I really like St. Patrick, and I've written about him a little bit. We don't know much about Patrick. What we do know comes from two poorly written 5th century documents that represent the earliest Latin writings from beyond the frontiers of the Roman Empire. The first and most famous document, his confession, tells of how, as a 16-year-old boy in Britain, Patrick was seized by Irish slave raiders and carried across the sea to work as a shepherd. In other words, he wasn't Irish, despite St. Patrick's Day parades. He was a Brit, okay? He was enslaved by the Irish, and miraculously he escapes and returns home and becomes a priest. Then Patrick began having a series of visions. He heard the voice of the Irish calling him to return as an ambassador of Christ to them. Patrick was also one of the first to clearly frame his ministry inside what we now call the Great Commission from Matthew 28. He believed that returning to Ireland would fulfill Jesus' final command to go to the ends of the earth. Ireland was the frontiers of human existence for him as a British young man. So he returns to the land of his enslavement, and herein lies one of the paradoxes of the missional discipline of remaining. Because Patrick knew himself as a stranger and sojourner who had nowhere permanent to lay his head, he was free within himself to make his home among the very people who had enslaved him. In other words, when his identity, our identity, is rooted in friendship with Jesus Christ, it frees us. That is our home. Our home is our relationship. So we're free to move outside our familiar comfort zone and to be at home anywhere. So then we come to the second, less widely known document written by Patrick, which is called the Letter to Caroticus. Now, it seems that a British chieftain named Caroticus attacked a group of Patrick's converts right after he had baptized them. Some were slain while wearing their baptismal robes. Others, including women who had taken vows of chastity, were carted off into slavery. And you know what that would mean. So Patrick is furious at his fellow countrymen. With every ounce of his spiritual power, he curses out Caroticus and hurls invectives and judgment at him. Of those who stole the new Christians, Patrick wrote, "Wherefore let every God-fearing man know that they are enemies of me and of Christ my God, for whom I am an ambassador, ravening wolves that eat the people of the Lord as they eat bread." In a powerful sentence that showed his total solidarity with his adopted people, the Irish, Patrick lamented, "The wickedness of the wicked hath prevailed over us. Perhaps they do not believe that we have received one and the same baptism. We have one and the same God as Father. For them it is a disgrace that we are Irish. Have ye not, as it written, one God?" Now, the key thing to notice about this text is Patrick's phrase, "We are Irish." Here's a man who is enslaved by the Irish, And he tells someone who's from his closer ethnic group to himself that he has become Irish. Just like Paul, who in 1 Corinthians 9 says that he becomes a slave to win slaves and a Jew to win Jews and weak to win the weak. Patrick has become Irish. His solidarity and friendship with the Irish was a link between their local culture and the larger baptismal community of believers from all races and nations. In Patrick's names, the converted sons and daughters of Irish chieftains set out across Ireland, uniting people from different clans into a common identity as followers of Jesus Christ. Patrick's influence was so profound that we remember him as the Apostle of Ireland, even though he was a Brit. Now, this is an example of what the missionary ethic of remaining. And mission practice over the centuries is full of lesser known friendships to which missionaries have given their lives so that the gospel might be shared across boundaries. One particularly moving example is that of the Mary Knoll sisters during the Second World War. Now, the Mary Knoll sisters were the first American Catholic women's missionary community, and they began working among the Japanese in California and Washington in 1920 and in Hawaii in 1927. They ran an orphanage and schools for the Japanese in Los Angeles. Because of racism and fear that they would betray the United States, over 100,000 Americans of Japanese descent were herded into internment camps in the U.S. after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. Japanese Americans had to leave behind everything they owned except for two suitcases apiece and move into prison-like barracks. Even orphans who were only 1/8 Japanese and only 6 months old were deemed a risk to national security and dumped into a desolate children's village in Manzanar internment camp. Now, two Japanese-American Mary Knoll sisters, Mary Hayashi and Bernadette Yochimuchi, though not required by law to move into the intern camps, moved into the Manzanar intern camp, as did other Mary Knoll missionaries. They remained with their people. They ran a home and school for orphans. From Seattle and Los Angeles, Mary Knoll fathers and sisters remained and abided with their Japanese parishioners. After the close of this infamous example of American injustice, Japanese Catholics worked to restore the Mary Knoll community in Los Angeles, and Japanese-American internees continued to worship in the crumbling remains of their chapels in solidarity with the sisters who were in solidarity with them. By the 1960s, Mary Knoll sisters were beginning to call this kind of lifelong friendship the spirituality of accompaniment. And there's a whole history there of how the Mary Knoll sisters around 1960 befriended three young Peruvian priests who had just come back from studying in Holland. The sisters, because of their friendship with Peruvian priests, wanted to move out of their communities and into the neighborhood. They moved out two by two in the spirituality of accompaniment, put on ordinary clothes, and began living among the people. As sisters Rose Dominic Trapasso and Rose Timothy Galvin reflected on this experience, they wrote, "Our living closer to the social reality of the poor has brought us closer to the mystery of Jesus, extended in time in all of our neighbors." This spirituality embodies Jesus' missional ethic of remaining, by remaining with the poor as their friends rather than living in separate institutions, Mary Knoll's sister lives out a theology of liberation. Now, these stories of the Mary Knoll sisters came full circle for me in October of 2010 when I went to the 100th anniversary meeting of the Mary Knoll Fathers that was held in Chicago. And I was there as a speaker, but they had an extra guest who came and sat next to me, and they said, well, wait a minute, because we want Father Gustavo Gutierrez to say a few words before you speak. So this very small Peruvian priest, Gustavo Gutierrez, whom I'm sure many of you know as the father of liberation theology, gets up in front of the group and he says, I'm here to celebrate the Mary Knollers because the Mary Knolls are my friends. And then he cites from the book of John and he says, Jesus said, I call you friends, not servants. You are my friends. And Father Gustavo said, and when people ask me what is meant by the preferential option for the poor, he said, it means being friends with the poor. And then he sat down. Being friends with the poor is what Gustavo Gutierrez, as an old man, summed up the meaning of liberation spirituality. Now, this story leads me to my second point, which is that of mutuality. So the first point was the history of mission is not just about going, it's about staying, about remaining. The history of mission is also about mutuality. In the midst of John 15, that wonderful chapter about abiding in the vine, Jesus says to his disciples, I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, because I've made known to you everything that I've heard from my Father. In a moving act of mutuality, as he prepared for his own death, Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. The Lord performed the role of a servant as a sign of equality with his friends. I do not call you servants any longer, but friends. Now, much of mission history, especially over the last 400 or 500 years, is embedded in a narrative of colonialism. We all know about that. 400 years of Westerners going to other parts of the world as part of colonial conquest. And mission took place within that. This colonialist mindset was often interpreted in the early 20th century as something called trusteeship. The idea that lower people are being in a trustee situation in relationship to the superior Westerners. Now, it's in this context that calls for friendship went out as a way to counteract the inequality of colonialism. That friendship is about mutuality, equality, respect. In 1910, at the World Missionary Conference in Edinburgh, which was the first full meeting of Protestant missionary organizations around the world, one of the most memorable speeches was given by a young Indian priest and future bishop, V.S. Azariah. Azariah was deeply involved in mission work in his native India. But the colonialist attitudes of the older missionaries meant that when he went into missionary homes, he didn't know if he'd be allowed to sit down, if he could drink tea from a cup and saucer, or whether he'd have to go around the back or stand. So Azariah gives this speech to all these assembled mission leaders in 1910, and what does he say? He said, This is a quotation from his famous speech. "The exceeding riches of the glory of Christ can be fully realized not by the Englishman, the American, and the Continental alone, nor by the Japanese, the Chinese, and the Indians by themselves, but by all working together, worshiping together, learning together the perfect image of our Lord and Christ. This will be possible only from spiritual friendships between the two races. Through all the ages to come, the Indian church will rise up in gratitude to attest to the heroism and self-denying labors of the missionary body. You have given your goods to feed the poor. You have given your bodies to be burned. We ask also for love. Give us friends." Now that speech kind of blew up the missionary conference in a sense. Many people agreed and other people refused to clap. But that cry, "Give us friends," became a counter witness to the colonial realities of Western imperial expansion. And it pointed out one of the biggest problems in mission. Mission does good. Mission helps people. But what about the lack of mutuality? What does self-sacrifice mean if you don't love and respect the people you serve? Friendship allows for relationships of give and take, of equality. The mutuality of friendship means we listen to the opinions of others and we take them seriously. We do not treat them like dependents or objects of charity. Cross-cultural friendship demands the mutuality of equal respect. And let me give a couple of examples of this ethic of mutuality from mission history. One of the most moving relationships, cross-cultural relationships I've encountered in the history books is that between the Presbyterian John L. Stewart, founder of Yenching University in 1919, with a family, the Few family. When he went to China, Stewart insisted that the Chinese and the missionaries live together in community to run the university, instead of the missionaries living up here and the Chinese living in little huts down there. So unlike most mission institutions of the day, the housing was identical and side by side. Stewart redesigned the campus in Chinese style. He cultivated close friendships with Chinese Christians who stood beside him despite all of the changing politics in China between the world wars. Stewart said that the best security in China lies in personal relationships, he said. That Chinese civilization, moral philosophy, and ethical standards are founded on human relationships. Those are quotes from Stewart. In 1946, Stewart became the last U.S. ambassador to China before relationships broke down, before the communist takeover. But he maintained hope that someday there would be reconciliation between the Chinese and the Americans. And in the relationship between John Stewart and the Few family, we see the kind of mutuality of friendship that I'm talking about. Together, Few was his student, but also worked with him and refused to accept payment. After suffering a stroke, Stewart lived for the last decade of his life with the Few family. In other words, when he was old and was of no use to anybody, he didn't move in with his kids. He moved in with this Chinese family who took care of him to the end, till he died in 1962. In 2008, now think how long, 62, 72, 82, 90, okay, 2008. After decades of effort, Few's son finally succeeded in having Stuart's ashes returned to China to be buried. Now that's friendship. Multiple generations, 80 years worth of friendship. Jesus referred to the deep love that undergirds friendship when he said, "No one has greater love than this to lay down one's life for one's friends." Now, I want to say that this kind of radical friendship is dangerous. It is scary. Having a friend from another culture can also be an act of defiance, though, of refusing to accept the status quo of hatred and suspicion that blames problems on outsiders. And another theme you see throughout mission history is the suffering of people who insist on having cross-cultural friendships. Because when the politics change, they look like traitors to their own group. During the 1960s and 70s, there was a 15-year civil war in Rhodesia, country now called Zimbabwe, between the white government and the black independence movement. My husband, Enos Daniel, who's a second-generation Dutch Reformed missionary, was running a theological education by extension program in rural areas. And he was called up to serve in the Rhodesian Defense Forces. But he refused to bear arms for the white regime. So Enos was accused of treason and appeared before a military tribunal where my husband said, "I cannot bear arms against the people with whom I am in ministry." Nevertheless, also, though, being white, he also risked his life whenever he went into the rural areas to work among the black people. So being a friend meant being caught between. When driving in convoys, the people behind him were taken out. People in houses on both sides of his were targeted and killed at night. How did he survive? Well, years later, he found out that one of his theology students in the Theological Education by Extension movement, a Bishop Forage, who was a bishop in an African indigenous church, had protected him from being ambushed. Forage made sure that his own people never shot my husband. Forage himself, for being friends with a white man, suffered at the hands of blacks, and for being black, he was arrested and tortured by the white government. What this story tells you is that in a world of divisions, cross-cultural friendship can be the most dangerous kind of friendship. People who live in mutuality across boundaries and who stand up for their friends across the human divide offend the principalities and powers. In a world marked by war and division, the mutuality of cross-cultural friendship is a counter-witness. This brings me then to my final category here mission history, and that's what Martin Luther King Jr. called the beloved community. In 1957, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. addressed the Conference on Christian Faith and Human Relations in Nashville on the subject, "The Role of the Church in Facing the Nation's Chief Moral Dilemma." Speaking of the nonviolent protests in the civil rights movement, King said, quote, "But the end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. It is an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. It is the love of God working in the lives of men." Close quote. Sounds kind of like Jesus, doesn't it? In King's concept of the beloved community, I think we see another way in which friendship is central to mission, the pursuit of community. The pursuit of community can be as small as when two or three are gathered together in the name of Christ, or as large as the kingdom of God. The condition of justice, peace, and joy, and the reconciliation of all creation. Before his death, Jesus prayed that his disciples would love each other, would be one with each other, just as he was one with the Father. He prayed, "As you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me." In other words, the presence of the united community of faith is itself a witness to the good news of Jesus Christ. Thus, the third ethic of friendship as mission that I'm pursuing, that of building up the beloved community, is itself a witness to God's love. Now, today you read a lot and talk a lot about world Christianity. I'm a professor of world Christianity. What does that mean? Well, often when we talk about world Christianity today, we think about demographics, as that statement was read. Well, there's many Christians in Africa now. There are many Christians in Latin America, many Christians in Asia. Only 25% of Christians are Europeans, and so on. But when you look at the origins of the idea of world Christianity that came about in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, that wasn't the image. The image of world Christianity was this vision of the reign of God in which all Christians would be united. And Protestants started building, very painstakingly building movements to communicate and relate together around this idea of community. One of these movements was a student movement. Students were some of the first Christians, Protestant Christians, in the late 19th and early 20th century who communicated with each other. Just like students now are at the front end of social media, students 100 years ago were at the front end of what was then globalization. And this is an aside, but I was reading something from around 1910 talking about wireless. I thought, oh, what is this, wireless? Well, of course, they mean radio, okay? And this commentator said, well, the only people who can really understand how to work wireless are like 15-year-old boys. I thought, boy, nothing has changed. So 100 years ago, students caught this image of unity, I mean, like about 120, 30 years ago, and they started relating to each other through telegraph and through travel, you know, and said, we want to be one. Well, then they get hit by two humongous world wars. What happens to your vision of world Christianity when you're shooting at each other? And there are many moving moments in this history where you can see the very discovery of the concept of world Christianity. One of my favorites is something called the World Conference of Christian Youth that took place in 1939 in Amsterdam. 1,500 delegates, students came from around the world to a big student conference. Now, this is 1939. They knew what was happening. So they named their conference Christus Victor after 1 Corinthians 15. Despite the trauma they were about to face, they wanted to assert the victory in Jesus Christ. Over 100 of these students were from Asia. 50 were from Africa. It was the most inclusive meeting of students that had ever been held in the world in terms of geography. The students marched in wearing national costumes with the Salvation Army band. So they showed their pride in their nation. But then for 10 days or so, they worked together, helping each other. Black and white students from South Africa talked about race. The Chinese students helped the Japanese students understand it translated for them, even though Japan had invaded China already. And on and on. A secret delegation of students came from Germany with messages from Dietrich Bonhoeffer, because the Nazis had banned the student Christian movement in Germany. United students are dangerous. So this incredible meeting happens. The students swear to remain united. They go home. A month later, Hitler invades Holland or whatever. I forget which country. Yeah. Okay. Right. Thank you. Hitler invades Poland. France and Great Britain declare war on Germany. Their draft notices are in their mailboxes. A month later, the Canadian students get torpedoed on a boat by a U-boat. Well, what happened to all of this? This dream, this vision of unity. The vision of beloved community did not die. I know of a veteran living in the Boston area who was shot down over Germany and with severe injuries was put into a concentration camp. He would have died, except it turns out that his guard was a member of the German Christian student movement. The guard secretly brought him medical care that saved his life. Another example of what was seen as hope for world community coming out of World War II. When Western pilots were shot down over the South Pacific, the indigenous people came out and said, "We're Christians too. The missionaries were here." And they often hid flyers, the Westerners. These kind of acts of friendship that occurred in World War II meant that after the war ended, Western theologians pointed to this and said, it really is possible that there is something called world Christianity. It really is possible, a vision of Christians in community. The Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu noted that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Another translation of that famous aphorism says, a journey of 1,000 miles begins beneath one's feet. Now, that applies to friendship and to the idea of the beloved community. Friendship starts not with a disembodied notion, but with concrete, specific, personal commitments to friends. Your personal commitment and relationship with Jesus Christ is a model for your friendship with others, with real concrete people not like yourself. The visions of beloved community, of Christianity as worldwide fellowship, begin with concrete friendships between real persons. Ours is not a disembodied faith. We follow a living God we know as Emmanuel, God with us. The mystery of the incarnation leads us to friendship as a missional practice. Now let me conclude. In this lecture, I've drawn upon mission history to explore friendship as a missional ethic. The practices of remaining, not just of going, but of staying. The practice of mutuality and of creating a beloved community. The next time we sing about Jesus being our friend, the next time you might sing about walking and talking with Jesus, I challenge you to enter the depths of Christian discipleship. Cross-cultural friendship is grounded in our common relationship with Jesus Christ. It shares It shapes shared visions of shalom. It creates community broader than our nuclear family and our little tribe. We are the links in a chain that begins with Jesus himself and it moves down through history. And as our relationship with the Lord propels us outward, we bridge the gap between the local church and the future reign of God.